is preposterous because it makes the assumption that you're using the tower as a self-standing structure, even though you might be smart enough to put guy wires on the top. Take a self-standing tower or a crank-up tower and install guy wires near the top just to support your 6-foot dish in a high wind, and all of a sudden lots of magic takes place. I haven't given you an answer, but I think I've given you some of the variables involved, Gordon. W2TTT, K2RIW.
Okay. Yes, and it is prime center fed, so that would be it. I have a couple of dishes. I have one, which is a grid dish, which I screened over with a quarter-inch hardware cloth years ago. And, you know, the surface is adequate for 1296. Probably too big a dish for 2304, but maybe not. You know, we'll see. I can see they do a smaller dish for the reasons you alluded to when you thought I was talking about 10 gigs. And, yeah, I get that. I do own some loop yakis. I have some medium-sized and some long ones. But your points about their qualities when wet and icy are oh so true. I'll just leave it at that. I'm thinking of doing this for a portable operation where I can guy it off and I'll be up on a rock somewhere so it's not too bad, and if things get ugly I can just, you know, tilt the sucker over and not worry too terribly much. I just want to clarify one thing. If the, you know, the wind loading at 100 miles an hour is roughly 50 pounds per square foot, I mean, I can calculate the surface area of the dish, but because of the parabolic shape of a solid dish, if I choose to use that, because I have one of those too. I even have an 8-footer too, by the way. That's too big to move. But the bottom line is if I use that, would I also have to, you know, add some sort of factor? Because I got to believe there's some sort of, you know, should we say, additional, should we say, loading effect because of the parabolic nature of the surface. I mean, it's not square and it's not round. It may be potentially worse and therefore potentially more catastrophic. What do you think, Dick?
Yeah, a parabolic dish, when the wind blows straight into it, gives you the amount of wind load approximately equal to a flat object of the exact same cross-sectional area. So there is no magic about it being cupped in shape versus being flat, very close to the same number of square foot of wind load, so to speak. And is it exactly 50 pounds per square foot for 100 mile an hour wind? I may have those numbers wrong, but you can look that one up. That's a fairly easy one. When the wind blows across the side of a dish, it acts a little bit like a wing. It creates lift, and now you get a force in the slightly different direction, and that's something to worry about. And there's references. You can go to that one. I can't remember the name of the Don document that explains all of this. Slipped my mind right now. EIA 422, something like that. Electronic Industries Association document, RS 222. I think it's called RS 222 Charlie or RS 222 Echo by now. It's slowly coming back. There's a document like that which has all of these definitions of wind load of various round and flat objects on a tower, the antenna, the dish, and whatever. So the wind load is something you can calculate. You in New Jersey probably live in something like a 70 mile an hour wind area. Once per 50 years, if you can double check that, your particular piece of property in New Jersey will be hit with a 70 mile an hour wind. And if you can project for, let's say, 100 mile an hour wind, the chances of you losing the antenna are very, very slim. So those are some pretty nice ways to go. You'll get a cleaner pattern out of the dish than you will with the Yagis. You get a lot less wind load with the Yagis. You get some water concerns. As you can tell, there's pluses and minuses, and you're right at the threshold that I normally use 1,000 megacycles. Above 1,000 megs, I favor dishes. Below 1,000 megs, I favor Yagis. And you're right at that threshold on both 902 and 1296. So you could go either way, and you're not wrong. And there are pluses and minuses of each way, and which ones are most important to you. I presume you're willing to put guy wires on the tower so that the 6-foot dish is not going to blow over the whole tower, and in which case supporting it in the wind is a...
Repeater, time out.
Therefore, supporting it in the wind is very doable. I don't think we should go to your second question right now before we go through the whole list. Back to you, Gordon, for any other comments on this. W2TTT, K2RIW.
Second question, and just answer it in due course, even if I'm not there, because I'll be able to listen. Just I had to pull over here because, as you know, coverage over here is a little choppy. By the way, one of the things that I could do is if we can get bidirectional access, we could probably use Echolink off of one of the local repeaters here and add that to the net. That might be a good idea to consider, but we'll get to that another day. All right, so what I'm going to do is I'm probably going to use like a two or three element Yagi feed for 1296 and another one for 903. So I probably could use those and just invert them with respect to each other on the same boom. And that would be a good way to illuminate this thing. The other thing, to get that zoom effect you talked about, if somebody had either a relay or another coax to feed it, the other approach is I could use a medium-sized loop Yagi on each of the bands on top of the dash just to give me something that's maybe not quite as sharp but adequate for the purpose. And that might... that might be a compromise installation. All right. Well, thank you, Dick, and thank everybody for listening. And I do want to hear people's thoughts about 4 meters. I kind of screwed up my line of thought there on the reflector, but neither here nor there. Thanks a lot, K2RIW, W2TTT.
Yeah, I'm going to give you a couple more words about the zoom control. In the case of 19-element Yagis on 432, they've got a beam width of around 25.5 degrees. So with my 16-Yagi array on the top of 100 feet of tower, with one main feed line going up the tower, which goes into a power divider which feeds the 16-Yagis, but I put relays in various places of that power divider phasing harness, such that I had the ability to feed one single Yagi at the top of the tower, one vertical string of 4 Yagis, or the whole 16-Yagi array. When I did that, I went from a 25 by 25.5 degree beam width with one Yagi to a vertical string where it was 25 degrees in elevation but 5.5 degrees in azimuth. And then when I flipped to the third position, in fact, I got it backwards, 25 degrees in azimuth but 5 degrees in elevation, and then it became a 5 by 5. I made 6 decibels of signal strength change on each one of those steps. So in other words, in 2 steps of 6 dB up and then 12 dB up, the signal would be stronger when I zoomed in on them. But to find the guy with a 25 by 25 degree beam width is difficult and on 432 sideband during a contest because you've got side lobes all over the place and his signal strength is going up and down with QSB and his sideband modulation. Watching an S-meter, it's kind of hard to figure out what's going on. So I would start off in one of the broader beam width controls, call CQ or zoom in, or find the guy, switch the antenna back and forth, and make sure he's in the main lobe because I'm using a 25 degree beam width, then click to the more narrow beam width, and his signal would get 12 dB stronger out of the noise, and I could blowtorch him, so to speak. If he has a weak signal and he might not hear me, I want to make sure the peak of the beam is aimed at him, not one of the side lobes. So there were 3 contests where on a VHF contest that goes from 6 meters to a zillion gigahertz, I used nothing but 432. Never used 6 meters, never used 2 meters, used no other band. On 3 contests way back in the dark ages, I won the New York, New Jersey section. The Hudson Division won the contest on the VHF using nothing but 432 and that zoom control. Real fun operation. So it has some advantages, and doing that with the dish is very difficult.
Repeater, time out.
Better go over to the next person who had a question, who I think was Paul, WS2N. Paul, you probably got a question, and also we're going to, not immediately, but we're eventually going to want to hear about how the astronauts are doing. I've been hearing that they had some trouble feeding a making a gyro fit and a stuck bolt and a stripped head and whatever. But it seems, they seem to have solved every one of those problems. WS2N, you got a call. K2RAW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. I don't have a question tonight, but I was going to talk about the Hubble Space Telescope. We'll get back to that later, you said. So we'll be here. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, glad you're one of the guys that can hang in there. Sorry that Frank couldn't make it. Let's see. John, KC2 Tango Delta Yankee, I think it was. Are you there, John? KQRIW. My name is Dick. Okay, I think we've lost Frank. We've lost John. Was there anyone else? Let's see. Steve, I'm not sure if he had a yes or a no. KC2MDP, did you have a yes as far as having a question for the net tonight?
KC2QAQ with a possible question.
Gordon, Glenn recognized. Steve, are you there?
Yes, Dick. No questions tonight, so you can pick up Gordon.
Okay, before I pick up Gordon, let me make sure I haven't left somebody, because if I did, they're going to be awful angry at me. Is there someone else who has already signed in with a yes, which means they had a question, and we haven't gotten to them yet? Please speak up now. Is there anyone else? There being none, Glenn, you've got the floor. KC2QIQ, go right ahead.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. Actually, my question is kind of broad-ranged and maybe a little bit of opinion, too, but... one of the things I guess you might have heard, Andy and I have been doing these transmitter hunts lately, and what I was wondering is I was thinking of picking up or building some kind of a handheld Yagi. I know a few of them exist out there, and being that you're the guy with all the Yagi experience, I was wondering if you have a preference or some kind of a handheld arrangement for a Yagi that would be pretty useful in transmitter hunting, mainly as portable use. Over to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, I wish I knew who, and maybe somebody's going to chime in and tell me who, has in the past discussed the fact that radio sport, I think it's called, is a popular kind of VHF hobby that exists in places like Japan, where I think it's their version of a bunny hunt, but they do not use automobiles. The guy's hiding somewhere in the woods, so it's a combination of, call it backpacking, running around with high directivity antennas in your hand, portable equipment, and finding this guy in the woods, who's the rabbit. They have invented a whole series of antennas, Yagi-like antennas, which are very light, very portable. The elements fold, the boom folds, everything comes apart when it comes to very portable, packing the antenna into a backpack when you're not using it. And it's quite easy to use when you're using it. So a portable three-element beam on 2 meters, in my opinion, is very easy. Mechanically, how do you do it? I think there are products that already exist, and whether or not you're going to buy one of those products, which are not too expensive, or build your own, that's up to you. So a three-element Yagi, I think, would be a three- or four-element Yagi on 2 meters, is, in my opinion, with proper construction, quite transportable, handheld, and quite directional, and... would solve the problem. Three elements is what I would go for. I've had a three-element Yagi with a Armstrong rotation mast that I stuck through the armrest of my station wagon, and it would come out the window and go straight up in the air, and I could rotate that mast as I was driving the automobile, and I did do some direction finding with that way back in the dark ages. Didn't go on bunny hunts with it for a bunch of reasons. Never got around to that. But that is a possible mode of operation. So I think that's what you're looking for. A rotatable Yagi you can put on the car, which you can easily now put in your hand when you go into the woods to go the last 500 yards to find that bunny that's hiding in the woods. Is that what you're after, Glenn? Here we go, Gordon. That's a very doable thing. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
It's more elegant and much more destructive.
Okay, we had a triple on that one. I didn't get anybody except something is more directive. One at a time, you guys. Try again.
It's much more directive. It's better
better for hunting down and getting a precise lock on things. W2CCC pulling into the driveway.
Can KEY would comment also?
Okay, Gordon, you said something is much more directive. What is more directive than the three-element Yagi, Gordon? Go ahead.
Four
elements. Okay, Gordon's recommendation is four elements. Mel, K2KEY, what would you recommend?
One of our club members made that one that I think would feature the, like you say, one of Japanese type of groups that gets together. And, of course, you mentioned portability. The elements pulled up, they're actually made from tape measures, salvage tape measures. And it's really easily pulled up, very portable. And WW2W, Tony, made it and demonstrated at a club meeting, Dick, over.
Okay, WW2W. He demonstrated. You made it sound like this was an article that appeared in one of the popular magazines. Was there an article, and do you happen to know what magazine that was, Mel? Go ahead.
Sorry, mentioned it, and I don't remember, but it was some article that was that mentioned that where this group that are very active in this type of amateur radio, you know, hunting, fox hunting, whatever they call it, and they experimented with a number of different designs, and they came up with this design, and very nice the way it's made on a piece of PVC pipe, and using, like I say, tape measures so that the thing, yeah, nice, it folds up, you literally, you know, can easily get on a bus or something with it, Dick, over.
Sounds like Tony built it. You've seen it in operation. Sounds like he was quite pleased with it. And did he actually use it on any fox hunt, to your knowledge, Mel? Go ahead.
Well, he demonstrated it at a club meeting, you know, questioned him on it, but I don't know how many, you know, actual field expeditions he went with it after that. But, you know, I heard a number of people ask him about where he got the idea from and all, and I think I just say he picked it up, I believe, on the Internet, over.
Okay, that's something for Glenn to go seek, if you think it's an Internet article, or get a hold of Tony, Whiskey 2 Whiskey, in the Kings County Radio Club, and find out how he did it. Looks to me like somewhere between 3 and 4 elements is the ideal size, depending on how much directivity, how much gain, and how much size you're willing to carry. I think 3 is adequate. Gordon strongly feels that 4 is the right number for a portable operation. And I do recommend that you put something on the tips of the elements, like blobs of rubber or whatever, to make sure that if it strikes you in the eye while you're running around in the woods, that it doesn't do eye damage. So do worry about the tips of the elements of the vertically polarized 2-meter beam that you're going to be carrying. It's capable of doing damage. Picture the skinny elements that they use, for instance, on Cushcraft Yagis, which are 8-inch diameter aluminum rod, and they're all, roughly 38 inches long. And if you're carrying one of those Yagis real close to your face, I can see a million scenarios by one of those rods could hit you in the eye and possibly do damage. So that's the main thing I would worry about. As far as making the elements collapsible or twistable so that they fold flat against the boom and the boom collapsible, there's quite a few ways that the antenna can be made to get into a very small package when you're not using it, and to still be quite light while you're using it and strong enough to do the job. It doesn't have to survive an 80-mile-an-hour wind when you're going to be using it for what I think you're going to be doing with it, Glenn. KC2QIQ, good luck with that project, and let us know how it turns out. K2RAW in the TechNet.
Yeah, very good, Dick. Thanks. It looks like I'm using it, for the fox hunting. And, you know, this past weekend we had one, and I wound up actually putting it in a preserve. And then I realized, wow, once everybody gets past the Dopplers in their car and you come up to fences and preserves, you really need something a little more directional than just the antenna on the HC. But definitely look into that. Thanks again. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, I think you...
H2SAY.
Doug, the H2SAY recognized, going to get you in a second. And glad we listened long enough to hear you. Gordon, I think you were the rabbit, and give us a couple of words as to a few words as to how the bunny hunt went, and how difficult was it for people to go the last 500 yards to find you. Back to you, Gordon.
Well, it actually went off pretty well. I got the box from Andy, and I hit it on time, got everything going, and I figured, because the preserve was actually pretty close to Sunrise Highway, and, I figured, I would probably start seeing people pull up within the first 15, 20 minutes, especially the more seasoned guys. And then next thing you know, 15 minutes went by, 20, and then what I realized was, yeah, they found their way pretty close to the preserve area, but the issue is that there was a fence pretty close to where the transmitter was located, so the only way that, to really come into the preserve was from, directions like a quarter of a way around the block, so a lot of people had difficulty finding the entrances, and when they did find the entrances, to actually make their way back to the transmitter was a lot more difficult, so it actually went pretty long. Unfortunately, I think a few people actually got disgusted and quit, even though we were giving hints at the end. Back over to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Under the circumstances, sounds like you made it kind of difficult. And Doug, to the AQSAY, I wonder if you've gone on some bunny hunts. What's your favorite kind of portable antenna? And Doug, your audio was a little bit low, so eat that microphone when you respond to us. Glad to hear from you out in the... I think you're in the Rocky Point area, but I'm not positive. So the AQSAY, KQRIW.
KQRIW in the
group,
yes, I'm in Rocky Point. Sorry about the audio. You mentioned it a couple of weeks ago, and I really haven't come up with a convenient way to put it. Anyway, it seems to me that some years ago, there was an article or design by somebody who had a gadget which would use two vertical dipoles spaced maybe a half wavelength apart, and would modulate the signal between them so that as you rotated the structure that had the two dipoles on it, you could tell exactly where it was coming from. And I think this was originally designed for aircraft finding, but I'm not sure. This was a while ago, probably 20 years ago. We dropped it in a second. Okay, anyhow, I don't know where the information came from, but you probably have one according somewhere. And I tried to build one once, and I was not particularly happy with it, but I wasn't really doing bunny hunting with it, so... Anyway, back to you and the group, WA2SAY.
Very good. WA2SAY, K2RIW. I'm now remembering this article. I think it might be in the ARL antenna book. When it comes to direction finding, there's about five basic techniques. And what Doug is referring to is that there is a direction finding technique where you have a pair of vertical dipoles on a horizontal piece of wood, let's call it, and by comparing the phase angle of the signal that's arriving at the two separate vertical dipoles, you use the thing's broadside, and by comparing the phase angle between the two, you get a very good direction finding technique. And now the expensive approach would be to have the two dipoles go into two completely separate receivers running from a common local oscillator and compare the phase of the reception between the two at the final detectors. That would be the Cadillac approach. By rapidly switching back and forth between the two dipoles, or by combining the signal between the two dipoles into a power divider, but phase shifting one versus the other with a turnable dial, there's various techniques by which you can direction find with this thing. So a pair of vertical dipoles as an interferometer direction finding system is a smaller, more compact antenna, but a slightly more elaborate receiving setup. Whereas the three-element Yagi going into any kind of a portable receiver that has either an audio or a meter or a bar graph or whatever signal strength indicator is the other approach. And the signal strength indicator approach, you probably are going to need a step attenuator somewhere, because when you start getting close to the bunny, the signal is going to get so darn strong, inverse square law is not working in your favor, so to speak, that it's going to saturate the receiver, and measuring signal strength as you sweep the Yagi around in azimuth is going to be difficult to do without that step attenuator. So, whereas with the phase comparison technique with an interferometer, it doesn't matter if the signal is too strong. You can still do direction finding right up to being a couple of feet away from the bunny. So there's pluses and minuses. But when you look up, when you do a Google search on direction finding techniques, RF
repeater, timeout.
When you do a search on RF direction finding technique, you'll find that quite a few ways of doing it. And so the two vertical elements and a phase interferometer is certainly worth considering. Anybody else want any further comments on this? Give me your call letters right now. KQRIW in the TechNet. Now, let me ask you guys to do me a bit of a favor. And that is a good friend of mine, W2KRM, Whiskey 2 Kilo Radio Mike, George Flanagan, has been collecting historic equipment, historical information about what he feels is the birth of radio. Long Island, we call Long Island the birth of aviation. He also feels it's the birth of radio, the early days of radio. You had all kinds of radio things going on with Telefunken in the 1915 time frame, having a major site in, I think it was Sayville. You had RCA, their major site in Rocky Point. You had McKay Radio with their major site in Hop Hog. You had some radio-like operation going on with Tesla. You had Marconi on Long Island. I think he had a shack in Bay Shore at one time. So there was a lot of radio pioneering that took place on Long Island. In roughly the 1985 time frame, the McKay radio site in Hop Hog and eventually the receiving site out in Southampton was dismantled, and quite a few people visited those sites, picked up blueprints and log books and whatever, and photographs of various installations. The radio site in Rocky Point was essentially dismantled around that time frame. So you got Southampton, you've got Hop Hog, and you got Rocky Point all being dismantled in approximately the same decade, because press wireless overseas radio was all being replaced by undersea cable and satellite work. So if you or any of your friends, let me drop, know of some of these people who collected material at that time, collected blueprints, log books, photographs. George has an extremely significant collection of radio memorabilia type things about the early days of radio on Long Island. He feels that, as I said, Long Island is one of the birthplaces of radio, just like it's the birthplace of aviation. So if you have any kind of material like that, or if you know of somebody who has collected that kind of material, W2KRM would like to see it, duplicate it, talk you out of it, buy it from you, whatever. Get a hold of me. K2RIW at RIW.products is one set of email address, or K2RIW at ARRL.net. Let me know who is the name of the person who has memorabilia information that George might be interested in, because his collection is one of the biggest collections I know of that kind of material, but he feels that there's more out there he would like to find. So if you've got a friend with that, please let us know about it. Okay? I think it's time we go over to Paul, WS2N. Paul, give us a nice description of where we stand with the Hubble repair. I think it's going well, and I think tomorrow is the last day of the last spacewalk in which they touch up the final improvements to Hubble. And this is the very last mission where Hubble's going to be visited for repairs and updates. And I think they put in a brand new camera that's going to give them something like 10 to 1 more sensitivity than they've ever had at wider frequency ranges and whatever. Sounds to me like despite the fact they had some sheared bolts and things that didn't quite fit, I think eventually they adapted and made everything go. I believe that's approximately what's happened, and tell us some more of those details. WS2N, a space expert, K2LIW in the tech desk.
Okay, very good, Dick. The whole system went very good today, with a lot of trouble. Let me put it that way. You're thinking of the gyroscope installation. They had some problems with that. Well, talk about bolts. They had big time bolts problems today with the with what they wanted to do. You've got a total of 5 EVAs. So today was the 4th, and yes, you do have one more tomorrow. Is that tomorrow? There's one more to go. I believe that's tomorrow. And they're going to put in another battery for the Hubble. They put in one set of batteries on EVA 2, and now on EVA 5, they're going to put another set in. When I said three per set. So they put in three the first time. Now they're going to put in three more. And that's the next EVA. And then you have the fine guidance sensor. They're going to remove that, replace that as well tomorrow. Today was a big problem. Let me drop it. They dedicated like 3.5 hours initially for they call it the space telescope imaging spectrograph. It's really a power supply system repair that they wanted to do for this thing quit 2004. They haven't used it since because of a low voltage power supply problem. Well, to get to this, they needed to remove 111 screws holding on the two sets of panels to get to a computer component, computer board. They wanted to pull that out and replace it. So they started off by getting ready. You know, they have this big plastic box that they attached to the main panel to remove all these screws. We talked about that when we dropped it. So they don't lose all the, you know, all the screws when they do this. But they figured on removing a handle, a grasping handle that spacewalkers would use that's attached to the Hubble. They needed to remove that first. They knew they were going to do that, which was held down by 4 bolts. And then this setup would fit flush on the metal cover, and they'd be able to stick their drill motor through and take out hundreds of these little screws without losing them. But to put this on flush, they needed to remove this handle. So three bolts or screws came out okay on this handle, the last one. I mean, they fooled with this thing for about an hour. I was listening to them. And they tried putting it, even going down and getting another bit, putting that in, using all kinds of force. And no matter what they did, this thing wouldn't come out. So they went to a plan B of getting behind the handle and removing the brackets and everything that holds this. They wanted to remove the brackets that holds this handle together. And apparently that was going to be too difficult. So what they did is plan C. Let me drop it. Mike Massimino from Long Island, he originally out of Franklin Square. He was the lead spacewalker. He read the whole of the handle after going back and forth with NASA and all the engineers at Hubble. To handle the they have a duplicate Hubble setup for all the equipment. And they figured out down on Earth that if you put about 60 pounds of force on this handle, it would move out of the way because it's being held by one bolt. They'll actually be able to bend it out of the way. And that they did. And that,
that worked out. And they were able to put on this capture plate plastic assembly and remove all these screws and eventually get to the printed circuit board. They could have grabbed the board like you would grab at a computer to pull the board out. They had some kind of grasping setup to remove this. If you grabbed it, you're taking a chance of putting a hole in your glove. But that all went well after having problems with this safety handle that they had to remove. So I was glad to hear they got that, but they had to drop the end of the spacewalk. They plan on putting more insulation on, things like that. They're gonna ship that to EVA-5. Let me drop it. When I think about this mission, they have already so many accomplishments. The EVA-1, they went out with something called a wide field camera 2. There was a camera 1, now then there was a 2. Now this one's called wide field camera 3. I'm sorry. This is a big thing. I mean, if you go on the internet and you go to the NASA site and you look up the press kit, you can get 126 pages of information regarding this. And I think pictures are really better than what I could describe how big some of this stuff is. This FC3, this camera that they're putting in, it's really as big as a freaking piano, Dick. I mean, it weighs about 900 pounds. So it's like an older player piano. And when I think of that thing being shot up into orbit, and that's just one of these components, all this stuff is big. And it stands, the thing is made, it's 74 inches wide and 87 inches long, 26 inches high. It's a big contraption that they had to install. That was only day one. Along with they did have a science instrument command data handling system that they had to swap out on day one as well. And then on day two, they went in with another EVA crew, the same one as today, by the way. Michael Good and Mike Massimino. They went in and changed out they call it a rate sensor unit. Well, basically it's a gyroscope re-movement there. They replaced that. And that's another big contraction to it. Everything's on the heavy side here. Interesting about the gyros, though. I got this from the press kit. They spin at over 19,000 RPMs. They run on gas bearings. they float in some kind of fluid. And the way they power these things, the wires that go in, they go into power. The gyro is only as thin as a human hair. Maybe you know why they're doing that? I don't know. I would have used something a little heavier. I'm sure there's a reason for that, but that's what they're using. As thin as two little wires going into to power this thing. So I thought that was quite interesting. And on that EVA, they did the first set of batteries, which are really three batteries, one big battery module, each one weighing over 400 pounds. So, you can take the amperage of each one of these. There's something I forget what it was, but it came out to over 450 amps for amp hours for all these batteries combined, half a dozen of them. They lasted all these years. They're nickel hydrate, you call them. They're not really nickel metal hydrate. That's not the way they wrote it up as. I wrote it up as nickel hydrogen battery. Let me drop it. So
apparently these types of batteries are very good, but the replacement ones that they bought up are supposed to be a lot better, according to what I was reading. The development of them, they're able to last longer, be even more reliable. How they're going to be 15 years, I don't know. EVA3, they have something called a Cosmic Origin Spectrograph that they replaced, and some other work as well. But today was a big day, getting involved with that, all those screws. I was glad to see that worked out. We talked about that many, many times on the net, Dick. So, one other thing that they have is on EVA 5. They call this what's this thing called? It was some kind of a capture unit, a soft capture mechanism installation or something they call it. This thing is going to attach to the bottom of the Hubble. And, you know, the diameter of the Hubble is quite big, but I mean, this is a huge thing in itself, I don't know, 400 or 500 pounds, whatever it is. Very big in diameter. I think it's something like six feet or 7 feet in diameter. It's attached to the bottom. So in the future, they could dock with this. Let me drop it. They'll be able to dock with this soft capture unit. And the idea is to send a unmanned craft, a robot craft up there, grab a hold of this thing, and deorbit it after this Hubble is no longer useful. What's interesting is they made it for the same capture device that they're going to be using with the Orion spacecraft after the space shuttle is going to be retired. It makes you think, you know, this installation now that they're doing is supposed to last 5-10 years. Maybe 10 years down the road, they might send an Orion spacecraft up there, dock with this thing, send up a cargo craft, and have that floating dock with the Orion. Maybe they'll do another spacewalk and keep the Hubble going, you know, indefinitely. I thought maybe that was, you know, I mean, that thought crossed my mind. I mean, they said it's made for the future flights. So I have a lot more on this, but I think that's plenty for now. Turn it back to you. This is WS2N.
Very fine, Paul. Nice description of the Hubble repair mission. I think this is the third or the fourth in the series of Hubble repair missions. That handle that had a third bolt that wouldn't remove, that was jammed, and then they applied 60 pounds of force to bend the handle out of the way. Did they pivot that handle on that bolt, or did they shear that bolt? And if they sheared that bolt, where did the head of the bolt and the handle go? Back to you, Paul.
It didn't come off, so it's still hanging up there. They bent it out of the way, and the bolt apparently was being pulled through. And I heard Mike Massimino ask Mike Goody, I think it's pulling through about a quarter to an eighth of an inch. What do you think? And the other guy agreed. So apparently they sheared down. I don't know, sheared makes it sound like the thing was sheared off. I would say bent. Bent out of the way is more likely the best description. I didn't hear that. This handle came off. Listen through this whole thing through the Longfield Amateur Radio Club, 145.430. They do a good job. It's transmitting all the time. They do this with all their missions, 145.430. And didn't see it, Dick. So maybe I'll have a picture in the paper or on the internet or something tomorrow, Dick. But I'd like to see that as well. But apparently it was just pushed out of the way, and then they were good to go to attach this box, where they catch all the screws. By the way, I was always wondering how they did this. And once they attach the box to this main plate, all the screws are now floating around inside this plastic box. They have, you know, a million holes where they're going to stick the screwdriver through. the power drill. And what they do is when they pull this plastic box off, this plate, the cover plate comes off with it, and it goes back into the shuttle. And when they're done with the job, they pull out these boards that were bad, low power supply boards, put the new one in. The panel that they put back on is a completely different panel that they brought up with them. And they have apparently like little dogs on the thing. They made it sound like there were only two handles to turn, and now this thing is locked on. So my guess is probably a couple of dog type of arrangements. When you turn something and it grabs the back of it, and the tighter you pull that on, the tighter it pulls against the
repeater. Timeout.
Very good. I think it's Matt Harris, who used to be KB2BUA. He's now N2NDR, who lives in Huntington. I believe he's the man who owns the ground station, a television receive-only terminal, one of those 10-foot dishes that listens to the signal coming down and then retransmits it to the Lockfield repeater at 145.43, and he's been doing that for a lot of years. My only slight disappointment is that his particular TV receive-only receiver does have an audio bandpass that's a little bit muffled. In other words, the high-frequency notes out of that receiver are lacking, so when you listen to the astronauts talking, it is slightly muffled speech. I wonder if you recognize that, or is it just my receiver, Paul? And to your knowledge, I think the only repeater in the area within the sight of your and my antenna is the 145.43 that is repeating astronaut audio. WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, I know there's a 70-centimeter one in Connecticut. You probably need a good antenna to pick that one up. Muffled is, unfortunately, I cheat. What I do is, they always have these press kits that come out. You go to NASA site, or something to do is put in Google, STS 125, press kit. You get a half a dozen things to choose from. It was just under 5 meg, and you get beautiful pictures, diagrams, and stories of what they're doing. And more than that, you should see pictures of what this would look like if they needed to be rescued by Endeavour. Endeavour is sitting there on a pad. They call it SDS 400. If this thing had to go, SDS 400 would be launched, and it's really cool. They would put one above the other. The robot arm from Endeavour would come out and capture the Atlantis. And then they would do a spacewalk, series of spacewalks, back and forth, and all 11 people. That you would send a crew up of four, by the way, to rescue these people, and there's seven up there now, so you'd have all 11 coming back on one spaceship, so that would be interesting. But this is the type of stuff that you would get off the press kit. I think there's sometimes usually two press kits, one's like an abbreviated one, and then this one. And what you do is they also have, what I was going to say is, let me drop it. They always have the acronyms, all the acronyms that they're going to be using during flight, and from A to Z, So when they you're listening to them, and they'll say, somebody, Houston might say, move, to the port side of STIS, you go down your list and you find out, that they're really talking about the space telescope imaging spectrograph, So you do have to really fill in the blanks when you listen to Lockfield. You're right, Ben. You're 100% right. I'd like to see the audio a little cleaner. It used to be worse years ago. I find it's a little bit better in recent years. In fact, you didn't.
Yeah, there used to be a little bit of audio distortion as well as muffled, and the distortion has essentially been removed but it's still a little bit muffled. I'd like to have a lot more high-frequency response in there. So that particular earlier design receiver that Matt has been using could have a slight modification to its audio circuit, in my opinion, or the way it is coupled into his transmitter that transmits over to the lock field repeater. So I guess you're saying the only other repeater we can listen to astronaut audio is a 450 machine in Connecticut. There must be a machine somewhere in New Jersey that maybe I'm within sight of, but I don't know about it. Somebody should tell me about this. And the nice thing about the Lockfield machine for people who live in Suffolk County is they can walk around with their handy talkies and listen to astronaut audio. Some of it's fascinating. When you hear them taking a camera shot of various assemblies as they work on them so that they can study them later to make sure that everything was done right and they know what status it was left in. I am curious, Paul, in the case of the 100-and-some-odd screws that had to be removed with this plastic capturing device, did all those 100-and-some-odd screws removal, did that go fairly smoothly, or was one of those screws pesky and stripped the head? And were they Phillips-type screws or Allen key-type, if you happen to know? WS2N, K2RIW.
I remember seeing
Joe recognized?
Good thing, all about the Hubble service mission. I believe they were all Phillips screws on how they were going to do that when they were practicing, 6 months ago or so, maybe 4 or 5 months ago. Good show that they did. And they showed the capture device, but they didn't tell you what I know now is that this capture device is going to be permanently attached to this plate. That's how they were going to get this removed with all the screws. And today, to get to this, they needed to take one panel off with this plastic box, and then they needed to do another one. That it was like, I don't know, 40-some-odd screws in it. Or 38 screws or something in the first group, and then 50 some odd screws in the second group, totaling 111 to get to the board that they needed to pull. And even that, they had a special gadget made up so that they want to, you know, cut their gloves, decompressing out of space. So I was listening to Mike Massimino was doing it, and you know, he was counting them off. Say 21, and you'd wait about that long, and you'd hear 22, and then the other guy would say 22. They confirm it, so you'd hear numbers going off like that. And the first group that they went through, you know, say they got up to whatever number, 35, 36, and then when they did the second plate and got that one ready, you know, the highest number I think they went up to was 56 in that group. But yeah, it went that quick. I would say if it wasn't for this, they lost a lot of time trying to get full with this handle. I don't know how much time they lost, but they really made up the speed. It went that quick, you know, 33, 34. That's unbelievable. Back to you, Dick.
And we're going to get you in a second, Joe. One further question. I did hear what little I listened to the audio being repeated, that some kind of recharging of an oxygen pack was required where an astronaut during a spacewalk is going back to the airlock and connecting a hose to his suit for a period of time to recharge. Is it the emergency air backpack or whatever? What was going on there, Paul? I didn't understand that. Back to you.
I missed that, but if they're... See, they could stay out for an extended period of time. They do have a deal where they go back to the airlock, and they have, not the airlock, I mean, they go back into the cargo bay, and there's valves there that they plug into the suit, and they can recharge themselves with more air. And that's been going on for quite a few years now. Recharging capability. How often that they have used it, I don't know. I didn't know that they used it today. I didn't listen for the whole of 6-7 hours that they were out. So I missed that part. I did catch the part where they were investigating Mike's glove. Put like a little tear or hole in it, and they made him put it up there to camera and so they could see, get a closer look, because they would have pulled them in and they would have ended it earlier. They needed to stay out quite a while and, you know, pack things up, and the other guy was closing up the main doors and all. Maybe before that, you know, I would listen for a half hour on and off, and then maybe before that, maybe they had to recharge or something. That could be, Dick. They could stay out there 8, 9, 10 hours if they had to. I know if they recharge it, you know, they could go really indefinitely until they run out of water. They'll get hungry back here.
Okay, I did hear them doing recharging, and I thought I heard somebody going back to the airlock to do the recharging, and it took 10 minutes to do it on each trip, something along those lines. Joe, go right ahead with your question or comment. W2RYY, KQLIW.
Yeah, I have a comment with what you're talking about. If you're talking about the space shuttle audio as what NASA repeats on their TV channel, that's available off the IRLP also. I'm not sure if you're aware of that. There's an IRLP node out in the Jet Propulsion Laboratory out in California that takes the NASA audio and puts it out on their node, and they tie that particular node to reflect the number 9877. So if you dial into 9877, you can hear the shuttle audio when they're doing things.
And, Dick, I generally run it on my repeater, which is 447200. That's just I've been at Dayton, so I haven't been playing for a couple of days.
Aha, 447200. Glad to know that. Will that be operational tomorrow, Eric, is question number one. And question number two, I think you were at Dayton. Give us a few words of what Dayton was like. I think you had mild rain on Thursday or Friday and then Saturday. And then I think sometime on either Saturday or Sunday morning, there was a real gully rusher or something like that, is the way it was described to me by Kent, W5BJB. So what was Dayton like, and were you rained upon? Did it rain on your parade, Eric? KE2EJ, KQLIW.
KQLIW, KE2EJ. Actually, Friday was a beautiful and gorgeous day. Friday was so lovely and perfect. But the effects of our economic downturn pretty much showed up there. There were empty spaces. There were a lot of places where there were normally people and companies and stuff like that. It was absent. But Saturday was a bit of a misery. It rained in the morning. Before the flea market opened, and then later on in the day, the monsoons came, and the wind came with it, and it wasn't a lot of fun. And yeah, I wish I had known Kent was there. I'd have caught up with him. But, oh, well, shit. And I got myself some parts and some goodies and some pieces of blank PC board scraps and a bunch of other stuff. And also got me another screwdriver antenna for the car, so it looks more like a porcupine. K2IWK2 again.
I listened long enough. I talked to Kent for a couple of hours in his automobile as he was driving back from Dayton to Dallas, which I think is a 20-hour drive for him. And he was in the back hills of Kentucky during that time and about to enter into Tennessee, I think it was. And he saw a whole lot of downed trees because of ice storms that they've had in the recent past. Kent has been occupying two or three parking places at the Dayton Hamvention for probably 10 or 15 years. He's always there. So too bad you didn't go look for him. I don't know how you would know how to find him. I guess you have to make some kind of a mutual agreement that I'll meet you on 144.205 or something on a handy doggy and talk him in. Or just find out what space number he purchased, what three space numbers I think it was that he and his buddies purchased. So, hey, you two guys could have had an eyeball. Those empty spaces that you saw